That's Miyamoto Musashi. He's who wrote the Book of Five Rings. That's a famous Japanese samurai. Do you know who he is?
Why is Gurin no Sho so popular? Is it all hype, or is there something deeper? What follows is a thorough breakdown of every principle I see contained within the book. I struggle to call this a summary, as it's almost as long as the book itself. Maybe we can call it a meditation, as that word does well with the algorithm. Now, Gurin no Sho was written in 1645, in a land, language, and culture worlds apart from my own. In summarizing it, some of my own worldview unavoidably comes through. So if you're ever in doubt about the veracity of something, go back and check the original to make your own mind up. The translation I used was by Alexander Bennett. That said, I have genuinely tried not to distort the meaning. It's easy to get carried away in such summaries and begin talking of crushing your business rivals, or seeing Dave from sales driven before you, and hearing the lamentation of his women, but I have done my best to avoid this. At times, I do offer some suggestions for how Musashi's words can be applied to the 21st century, but hopefully when I do, it's clear these are my own thoughts and not those of a 17th century samurai. You can take them or leave them. Musashi structures his book in five scrolls, or rings, represented by the elements earth, water, fire, wind, and ether. Very broadly, these denote grounding, adaptability, combat, perception and practicality, and transcendence. My summary reorders the concepts from each of these scrolls, allowing those with strong connections to flow on from one another. I've marked all concepts and quotes with an elemental marker to indicate their source. With disclaimers and throat clearings out the way, let's begin. What follows are the principles of Musashi's way. 1. Generality across disciplines. Having attained the essence of the way of combat strategy, I practice the disciplines of many arts without the need of a teacher in any of them. While there are many arts, each with their own skills, there is a broad way which is applicable to all. Mastering the broad principles associated with this way allows one to excel across the board. To know one way in the broad sense means you will find commonality in all of them. Therefore, acquaint yourself with all arts, know the ways of all vocations. I teach that the warrior must practice his craft in such a way that it is practical and functional in all things and at all times, for this is the true way of combat strategy. In addition, good strategy is generally applicable on all scales, large and small. Although the principles I outlay here are explained from the perspective of individual combat, it is important that they be interpreted as equally pertinent to battles between armies of 10,000 men. In this sense, the way Musashi teaches is not something confined to the training hall. It encapsulates all elements of life all the time. As such, mastery is a continuous practice. You become what you continually do. So, to become masterful, you must practice mastery at all times, not just during training. You need to live it. The mindset in the way of combat must be no different from one's normal state of mind. In the course of your daily life and when engaged in strategy, there should be no change whatsoever in your outlook. This means your mindset, focus, and drive should be the same in everyday life as during training or combat. With all martial art postures, it is essential to maintain a combat posture in your everyday life and an everyday posture in combat. One mindset for this is to view the universe itself as a constant sparring partner. It tries to throw things in your path to disrupt you and spark mental resistance. This can happen at any time and at any place, so you must constantly be on your guard against it. But do not read into this that you should be agitated or aggressive. Always maintain correct mental and physical posture. On physical posture, Musashi says, the line of your head and nose should be straight, with the chin protruding slightly. The neck is upright with the nape tensed, shoulders lowered, back straight, backside in, and with the feeling that your whole body from the shoulders down is a solid entity. Push down from the back of your knee to the tips of your toes and thrust your abdomen slightly forward so that your lower back does not stoop. Modern research has demonstrated how conscious adjustments to physical posture can directly influence mental well-being. Considering the sedentary life many of us now lead, this feels very relevant. On mental posture, Masashi says, "Your mind should be expansive and direct, devoid of tension, but not at all casual." Staying centered is a popular term in usage today. It is echoed in Masashi's writings when he advocates for a balance between high spirits and relaxation. He cautions against being driven by emotional states, but equally against relaxing to the point of lethargy. Keep your mind centered, not leaning too much to one side, swaying serenely and freely so that it does not come to a standstill in moments of change. Both the high-spirited mind and the lethargic mind are signs of weakness. Masashi's view is compatible with the Stoic sense of acknowledging events for what they are and choosing how to react, rather than being driven by emotion. Such behavior requires control over your spirit. A warrior obviously needs spirit, but Masashi believed control over it was equally as important. Forge a spirit that seeks victory through the application of strategic wisdom. He dedicates entire sections in a few of his books to discussing shouting as a form of intimidation. However, he also mentions it is not something to be done at all times. To shout at your opponent does not mean that you are yelling all the time. The important point is that one's spirit should not be unbounded, but rather marshaled and directed like any other force. There are times to present a calm spirit to draw an enemy in. Keep perfectly composed as you present him with a feigned sign of weakness. And times to explode, to overwhelm them. Another way is to free your mind with the sole intention of routing the enemy from start to finish, and win with a spirit brimming with energy. You must have both the strength of spirit to do this and the strength of mind to rein it in. Properly engaged, spirit alone can crush an opponent before an engagement begins, overwhelming them mentally and cowing them into submission. Beat them just by looking with your eyes. With your spirit attuned to the way, you will triumph over the enemy with your mind. Shout down the enemy's vitality. What's more, when an enemy falters, it is important to crush their will to fight before you consider them beaten. Raise the enemy's spirit by ripping it apart so that he is defeated beyond doubt. Take care to confirm this. This can be accomplished by the use of a sword, with the body, or with the mind. There is not only one way to achieve this. If he is not pulverized, his spirit will remain. Naturally aligned with this is the principle of belief in yourself, seeing yourself as strong and capable of winning, never contemplating defeat. To crush is to see your opponent as weak and yourself as strong and smashing him to bits. In large-scale strategy, irrespective of their number, the enemy will show their vulnerability if they hesitate or are disoriented. At this point, crush the enemy from the top down. Overwhelm them with a burst of energy as if to push them back and obliterate them. Consider how this relates to modern sports science and practices of visualizing success to improve physical performance. A recognition of the connection between mind and body is only something that has recently returned to Western thought. Masashi goes on to point out that such a spirit is the only viable way to defeat multiple opponents. It's not feasible to defeat them conventionally. Rather, you should begin by attacking the strongest on one side, then, as he is pushed back, alternate to attacking the strongest on the other. Show no intention whatsoever of retreat, and use an overwhelming spirit to force them into submission. When fighting alone against several opponents, do not try to defeat each side. When the enemy is pushed back in one direction, turn and attack the strongest opponent on the opposite side. Sensing the cadence of your opponents, move as if zigzagging your way down a path from left to right, according to their reaction, in a rhythm that suits you. After determining the condition of your enemies, disappear among them and strike with no intention whatsoever of pulling back. Such a spirit requires not only absolute confidence in yourself, but also an absolute commitment to any task once engaged. commit with single-minded resolve to follow through to your mark and attack without deviating. For example, even if you have to deflect the whole world, the flight of your sword must not diverge from its path. Purge yourself of fear. This implies always holding the intention of success. From a Stoic perspective, we are not always in control of outcomes, but we are in control of our intentions, and, surprise, surprise, intending to succeed makes us more likely to. Bizarrely, it's easy to slip into the habit of never committing and almost planning to fail, either due to low spirits or just to avoid ridicule. If you never try, after all, you can't be accused of failing. Unfortunately, starting with the expectation of failure leads to weak, non-committal action. So do not set out to lose. In the words of Musashi, the way of my school is to win no matter what. Of course, when not in a life-and-death situation, you do need to temper this mentality with a degree of common sense, not to mention morality. But the notion of steadfastly holding the intention of success should not leave you. This leads on to the importance Musashi placed on maintaining focus. Do nothing which is of no use is an oft-repeated line associated with Musashi, seen to epitomize his unwavering commitment to focus. It is actually from his Dokodo, however it does neatly represent a thread of the Book of Five Rings. Avoiding everything which is of no use is likely an impossible target to truly achieve, but the point is to stay vigilant against wayward action, knowing that even one such case can lead to a lifetime of bad habits. What differentiates this way from others is the intrinsic risk that an error of judgment or a moment of confusion will plunge you into bad habits. Such errors of judgment can propagate and compound over time, all the while you mistakenly believe you are being disciplined. It's only after some time and when compared against the straight path that the true degree of the error becomes apparent. Wayward spirit. You may believe that you are practicing your discipline conscientiously and are on the right path, but you will deviate from the true way if your mind wanders. Departure from the truth becomes apparent when observed from the straight path. Musashi's approach was not to even contemplate wayward action as an option, to put all such considerations out of his mind. When something is not an option, it cannot tempt you. Think never to veer from the way. Train unremittingly in the way. The warrior must seek to put the way into practice each hour of every day without tiring or losing focus. In modern life, we have more opportunities than ever for wayward action. Having them around and attempting to resist them makes life more difficult than it need be. It is easier to maintain focus if you remove distractions entirely. In doing so, you no longer need to resist them. Delete social media. Throw away unhealthy food. Downgrade to a dumb phone. Put money in a locked savings account, etc. Such actions allow you to remain focused on what truly matters. It does, however, require directness of intention and practicality over form. The direct path is the soul of combat. Without the mind of direct path, your swords will be lifeless. The principle of knowing your goal and heading directly towards it is fundamental to Musashi's way. It constitutes a large portion of his criticism of other schools and is decidedly summed up in the line, "Take hold of your sword with the intention of cutting the enemy." One might think this to be rather obvious. What else would I head toward, you might say, than my goal? But in practice, it's easy to either lose sight of your goal or become fixated on the intermediate steps rather than their intended purpose. For example, in adopting a combat stance, it is easy to fixate on it and forget that it should only serve as an aid to your true purpose of cutting the enemy. When assuming any of the stances, do not dwell too much on what it is. Think only of cutting the enemy. Musashi referred to this specific case as stance, no stance, The idea being that while stances existed and were important, they were not where your focus should lie. You must not focus your mind on assuming a particular fighting stance. This is why I teach there are stances, but there is no stance. The concept, however, extends to everything. All stages of a sword fight are in service of cutting the enemy, and obsession over any other part, even the art of striking itself, is distraction. If you become obsessed with the act of parrying, slapping, striking, sticking to or pressing your opponent's weapon, the subsequent strike will lack vigor. The principles of heading directly toward a goal and staying focused on it rather than its intermediate steps are clearly transferable to modern life. You have only to replace adopting stances with clearing emails to see an example of it, granted with a less morbid end goal. In fact, one could make the case that since the general complexity of the systems and organizations we operate in today has increased, it's both harder to maintain focus and easier to hide our lack of progress from ourselves and others when we don't. Generally, any work which doesn't directly move us towards a goal can be thought of as busy work. Examples include emails, to-do lists, meetings, research, planning, filing, and tidying. Such things do occasionally need to get done, but indulging in them amounts to procrastination, as it usually means we're prioritizing comfortable but unimportant tasks over hard but important ones. It is illogical to dwell on small, weak techniques as you prepare yourself to slay an enemy. Small techniques are particularly inappropriate when you are suited in armor. In both combat and work, we should instead prioritize function over form, and do what works over what is correct or clever. Again, this sounds simple, but the mechanisms by which we undermine ourselves are numerous. Ego can mean we focus on form over function to try and look good. An example of this would be pretentious emails and meetings. Reverence can mean we respect an art too much to question the functionality of a form. Think martial arts or the following of any guru. And ignorance can sometimes mean we simply don't know the purpose of a form and so can only mimic it. This last mechanism can be seen in creators mimicking the long intro styles of TV broadcasts without realizing such frivolities serve no purpose online. Once any of these practices become ingrained, tradition and habit can mean they never get changed, with the form of things like recurring meetings and TPS reports carrying on long after their function has entirely vanished. It is bad to inhibit yourself and settle on a set stance. Finally, sometimes the sheer overwhelm and complexity of a project can mean we just lose track of our purpose. An example of this would be an entrepreneur concerning themselves with the form and accoutrements of starting a company rather than the product they're bringing to market. In all cases, a form is established to serve a function, but over time, focus shifts onto the form and the function becomes lost. Maintaining focus and remembering to question the function of things can counteract this. Ironically, though, questioning everything can be just as paralyzing as questioning nothing, so this very form of constant questioning must itself be tempered with practicality in mind. Musashi's mantra of take hold of your sword with the intention of considered before every major action could perhaps serve as a nice grounding method to do this. With directness in mind, Musashi offered his one-count strike. Take him with a single blow off the mark before he has time to contemplate drawing his sword, change his stance, or launch an attack. This strike aims to end engagements before they begin. It encapsulates the idea of directness and not overcomplicating, as well as the control over spirits necessary to obscure one's intention. The striking rhythm called one count, Itsubiyoshi, is to not let your will manifest in your body and mind, and strike from the void. The principle of immediate action can be extended to modern life with respect to our natural tendency to overwork solutions and balloon projects out of proportion. A famous entrepreneurial refrain from Peter Thiel goes, "If you have a 10-year plan of how to get somewhere, you should ask, Why can't you do this in 6 months? You could also consider the value of channeling your spirit such that you strike and complete tasks without feeling the need to first announce your intentions to the world. The principle of being judged by your actions rather than your words. Implied within the one-count strike is the importance of not overcomplicating. There are just 5 sword stances, and mastering them is enough for success. Practicing these 5 techniques thoroughly each day and honing your skills in the fray will lead to certain victory. His point here is that while many stances exist, they are all variations of the fundamental 5, and by grasping and drilling these 5, you will gain victory. By attentively studying these 5 exterior forms, you will grasp your own sword pathway and will learn to deal with all manner of attacks thrown at you by the enemy. Appreciate that there are no other forms in Nito apart from these 5. Be sure to drill yourself in them. This principle of simplicity can be applied to individual arts such as sword fighting or extended to life in general. Whatever the level of detail, the concept is there are usually a few fundamental forms from which more advanced techniques derive, and which, if mastered alone, will lead to success. That being the case, do not become distracted researching special techniques or forms when you are not a master of the fundamentals. Do not overcomplicate. As an example, in strength training, the bench press, deadlift, squats, shoulder press, and pull-ups are sometimes referred to as the Big 5. The number 5 is incidental, but the point is the same. A small core set of compound lifts can deliver most of the results necessary for progress, and it's more important to dedicate time and effort to these than to researching secret techniques. Expanded to life in general, there are core basics to get right to get life in order, and drilling into obscure techniques or forms tends to be a distraction. It is at once disheartening and liberating to recognize that at any time you have it within yourself to make progress, and that you are not lacking knowledge of what to do, but rather momentum in enacting it. The core basics are known to you. It's the will to action that is the challenge. Broadly, this idea bears some similarity to the modern Pareto principle. However, it's more to do with the existence of base forms upon which all other techniques are built, rather than of the diminishing returns described in 80-20. Associated with avoiding overcomplicating is the call to avoid developing teachings for their own sake. Musashi's primary criticism of other schools was that they deviated from directness and created forms, specializations, and teachings in order to justify themselves commercially. They create myriad forms for sword work, conveying the various stances as exterior and the way as interior teachings. Such schools have veered from the true path of strategy. Such inflation of techniques tends to occur as edifice is built around teachings. One starts out with the intention of studying combat, but by taking on students, one's aim morphs into running a school. Success then comes in increasing student numbers rather than perfecting the art. Today we might call this mission drift or goal displacement. Of course, it can also come about for purely commercial reasons, as Musashi says. Teaching myriad sword techniques is essentially exploiting the way as a commercial venture. By bamboozling novices with countless moves, teachers make them believe that their training method is profound. This approach to strategy should be rejected. Thinking there are assorted ways to strike a man with a sword is indicative of a confused mind. There are not so many ways to cut in the world. Real-world combat tends to serve as a corrective mechanism for hot air. Practitioners rapidly discover what does not work when their lives depend upon it, even if it's the very last thing they discover. At the time Musashi wrote his treatise, Japan had been experiencing a period of relative peace. Possibly this accounted for the rise in commercial schools, he mentions, as there were fewer corrective mechanisms to highlight their flaws. Other schools extol the virtues of their colourful, flowery techniques, like produce peddled to make a living. Is this not a deviation from the true way? An interesting parallel can be seen with the modern UFC. prior to unrestricted combat, there was much debate around which martial art was the best, and even a certain mythical aura surrounding many of the Eastern ones. Following the UFC, the debate largely ceased. What did and did not work had been tested, and the spectrum of practical styles collapsed. In the words of Musashi, they have no validity when viewed from the perspective of worldly truth. A secondary mechanism by which false teachings can arise can be found in modern psychology. It's long been demonstrated that humans give emotional answers first, then seek to justify themselves with logical rationalizations. Now consider the topic of where to place the gaze during combat. Musashi says, certain schools maintain that the gaze should be fixed on the enemy's sword. Others teach students to focus on the hands, the face, the enemy's feet, and so on. Setting your gaze on specific points will cause uncertainty and will adversely affect your strategy. It's likely that after a lifetime of combat, a fighter learns to intuit an opponent's behavior and predict his strikes. But when asked to explain how he does so, he'll rationalize a response, such as, "Always fix your gaze on the enemy's sword." This is, in fact, not how he does it, but put on the spot, it's the answer he provides, which then gets rationalized, passed on, and taught as truth. As Musashi says, he has no need to fix his gaze, as he can see what he is doing intuitively through lots of training. Likewise, in the way of combat strategy, the warrior learns, through engaging with different opponents, to determine the weight of an enemy's mind. With practice in the way, you will come to see everything, from reach to the speed of the sword. Generally speaking, fixing the gaze in strategy is to attach it to an enemy's mind. This indicates the purpose is to gaze into an enemy's mind and thereby see his intentions, but it speaks to a far more holistic manner of achieving it. Fixing the gaze is not about staring at a particular point, but about intuiting intention by staring into someone's mind. In both large and small-scale strategy, refrain from fixing your gaze narrowly. As an aside, it's possible the younger Musashi fell into this trap himself. In his 1604 treatise, Heidokyo, he says, "Direct your eyes on the enemy's face. Do not focus on anything else. Since the mind is projected in facial expressions, there is no place more revealing than the face to fix one's gaze." Which seems to contradict his later teaching that fixing the gaze on a point would adversely affect your strategy. It's possible the 20-year-old Musashi was repeating what he had been taught, or perhaps he developed the teaching himself, but revised it later in life. However, this is just my conjecture. The question of where to place the gaze leads on to the differentiation between observing and perceiving. Musashi differentiated looking in and looking at as two types of perception. The two approaches for observing are the eyes of kan, looking in, and ken, looking at. Perceive and know what cannot be seen with the eyes. Pay attention even to trifles. Elsewhere, he mentions two layers of mind as heart of perception and heart of intent. Collectively, these differentiations appear to be a recognition that there are surface-level observations of material events and intuitive observations of reasons and intents. The warrior must polish the two layers of his mind, the heart of perception and the heart of intent, and sharpen his two powers of observation, the gazes of kan, looking in, and ken, looking at. The art of intuiting what is occurring and seeing intention beneath events is naturally not something that can be taught through writing. As such, it is difficult to say more about the topic other than that Musashi felt it important enough to note the distinction. In his words, it's just something you need to research well. Inability to comprehensively see the most fundamental matters will make it difficult to excel. This leads to the point that the student is at the center of any progress. There is a modern school of thought that says the teacher should take primary responsibility for the success of their students. As an ideal for teachers to aspire to, this is admirable, But from a Stoic perspective, it's also something outside of their control. While they can inspire, support, and motivate a student, the final decision to act lies with the student. In the words of Musashi, the teacher is the needle and the student the thread. What's more, even if you're in full-time education, the majority of your time is still spent outside of school. So, the greater part of your opportunity for progress lies in your own time. It is difficult to write about such matters in detail. Read what I have outlined here and find ways to work it out for yourself. However, if a book simply tells you to go away and research things yourself, what use is it? While intuition cannot be taught, areas where learning can be found can be pointed out, and the individual can then seek it there for themselves. It's analogous to a map indicating where treasure is to be found, or in Musashi's words, "What I have recorded will serve as markers for those dedicated to pursuing this way." There is also a profound necessity for humility in any perceived progress. With anything truly complex, even years of practice do not guarantee a proper understanding. Musashi offers himself as an example of this. "I have devoted myself to studying the discipline of combat strategy since I was young. I remained undefeated in over 60 contests. After turning 30, I reminisced on past experiences and realized that my success could not be credited to a true mastery of strategy. Thereafter, I studied zealously from morning to night in a quest to discover the deepest principles. I was about 50 when I realized the real meaning of the way of combat strategy." This naturally leads to the concept of practice over theory. 1,000 days of training to forge, 10,000 days of training to refine. Nearly all progress comes through practice. And throughout the book, Musashi ends passages with the line, "You must research this well," reinforcing the point that theory alone is only ever directional. It can point the way, but not grant a full understanding. It is impossible to grasp the five exterior forms through simply reading about them. You must embody the movements by actual practice with swords. Personally, I feel this holds true even for theoretical disciplines such as maths and physics. Many times reading a textbook, I have felt I understood a topic only to be humbled when I tried to do the calculations. At the end of the day, it's only through real-world practice that you come to practically understand things. Physical training must also be done to the point that in pressing situations, your conscious mind is no longer involved and your hands and body act by themselves. Musashi refers to this as no thought, no form. Today, we would call it muscle memory. Your hands will also strike spontaneously with power, speed, and no warning. This is the strike of no thought, no form, and is of the utmost importance. It is encountered often, so must be learned well. This leads to the idea that you must absorb, not just memorize. Memorizing, understanding, and absorbing are three distinct levels of learning. Musashi emphasizes that principles should be absorbed such that they become a part of you, not merely memorized or emulated. They need to be embodied at all times. Simply reading these scrolls will not lead you to a mastery in the way of combat strategy. Even though the concepts espoused here were written specially for you, do not think it is a matter of simply reading, learning, or emulating my instructions. Think of the principles as emanating from within your own heart, and study hard to devise ways of embodying them at all times. Obviously, this is easy to state and hard to achieve, as it is only achieved through continued practice. However, acknowledging that different levels of understanding exist is useful. Even if words are insufficient, careful contemplation should heighten an intuitive understanding of the principles I am trying to convey. Now, just as physical muscle memory can allow your hands to strike spontaneously, mental muscle memory can allow your mind to strike spontaneously. Everyone has absorbed some level of this for different areas in their lives. Most of us do not consider dropping litter, smoking indoors, or cutting in line, for example, And yet such behaviours are learned principles, not inherent ones. They make up our habits and our culture, and could be thought of as mental muscle memory, or actions you perform without mental consideration. On a more conceptual level, one may first learn, then over time embody the action, of not complaining or making excuses. Such behaviour starts out as a conscious, effortful choice based on an understanding of principles, but over time becomes absorbed until such principles emanate from your heart. Musashi, of course, is referring to internalizing principles of strategy and the way, not simply good habits and worldviews, but the concept remains the same. Just as muscle memory can control one's instinctive physical actions, mental muscle memory can control one's instinctive mental behaviors. But establishing such instinctive behavior requires deep absorption of the principles. It's not enough to just rationally understand them. In studying anything, you should stay mindful of not becoming a one-trick pony. You should not become overly reliant on any one weapon or technique. The warrior should avoid harboring a preference for any given weapon. Musashi pointed out that many schools promoted themselves based on their specialization with a single weapon, the longsword school or the shortsword school, for example. But he believed you should use the weapon that makes most sense, not have a bias toward a particular one. If you rely on the short sword, you become accustomed to blocking rather than seeking to win, and if you favor the longsword, then you rely on keeping your distance. With no understanding of the deeper principles of strategy, they seek to win from a safer distance with a longer weapon. This is indicative of a weak mind, and is why I see their strategies as being feeble. Musashi made frequent comparisons between generals and master carpenters. To continue the analogy, imagine competing schools of carpentry proclaiming themselves the school of the wood plane or the school of the claw hammer, and favoring one tool over another. Such a situation would be farcical, and perhaps conveys Musashi's frustration with martial arts schools doing the same. So, voluntarily mix things up from time to time and stay curious. If you have somehow found yourself in a situation where one technique keeps bringing you success, remember it won't always work. Eventually, conditions will change, or your opposition will adapt. Train hard now so you're not found lacking when that occurs. When you are in a place where only a short sword is permitted, preference for a long sword will be your undoing, as it is a cop-out in strategic ability. Today, there are numerous online niches that can be exploited, and in doing so, it can feel as if you've stumbled across a secret technique for success. But such niches are also prone to vanishing overnight, as technology moves on or the world catches up. So keep this principle in mind. With respect to combat, a special one-trick pony case to keep in mind is do not rely on speed. Too much of something is just as bad as not enough. With a fast opponent, feign an attack with your body and mind and strike your opponent down after he responds. Considered theoretically, speed is always beneficial. But Musashi only ever spoke practically, and in practice, he said it was overrated. Over-relying on anything is a risk, and just like with over-reliance on long or short swords, there are times when speed can work against you. Specifically, Musashi mentioned swampy environments tiring you out, large-scale combat being chaotic, or times when cutting too fast can simply cause the cut to fail. If you try to cut quickly with a sword, the speed will prevent it from cutting. In the case of large-scale strategy as well, the thought of rushing things is hazardous. Speed-disrupting technique is not limited to sword fighting, and the principle is nicely demonstrated in a famous video of Michael J. White and Kimbo Slice. Kimbo easily dodges Michael's fast strikes, but is left dumbstruck at being hit by the slow ones. In the video, Michael says, "See, the idea is, I'm not going straight, I'm not telegraphing." Switching the focus to speed disrupts both these things, and the strike is dodged. While this seems counterintuitive, It is a demonstration of real-world effects over theory. Interestingly, a point Seneca often made about life was that we have plenty of time, provided we use it wisely. The consistent theme being, there is no need to rush, provided you are acting in a direct, purposeful manner. We are not given a short life, but we make it short, and we are not ill-supplied, but wasteful of it. The objection may arise, what if I maintain good technique and still increase speed? And this leads on to a fascinating, if esoteric, point about rhythm. Speed in combat is irrelevant in the real way. In all such things, what is referred to as fast means that the intervals are out of sync with the rhythm. And, as we'll see in part two, maintaining rhythm is paramount. To find out why, click here.